to look at, said the sergeant major, fumbling in his pocket. It's just an ordinary little paw, dried to a mummy. It had a spell put on it by an old fakir. He wanted to show that fate ruled people's lives, and that those who interfered with it did so to their sorrow.
This week on Selected Shorts, a classic chiller and the power of words.
For 5 centavos, she delivered verses from memory. For 7, she improved the quality of dreams.
I'm John Lithgow, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction, old and new, read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. Compulsion, an irresistible need to do something or have something. Powerful emotions can make us act in spite of ourselves, as we hear in the 2 stories on this program. W.W. Jacobs' The Monkey's Paw has been keeping readers up at night since it was first published in 1902. I got to perform it a few years ago. I wanted to read it so badly because it was absolutely my favorite story when I was a kid. It was a story that my dad used to read to me and my siblings, and it was undoubtedly our favorite. I think it was my first experience of the exquisite pleasure of being completely gripped by horror. You're going to hear me tell it, and as you listen to me, just imagine me hearing it as a 9-year-old boy. Here it is, The Monkey's Paw by W.W. Jacobs.
Without, the night was cold and wet, but in the small parlor of Laburnum Villa, the blinds were drawn and the fire burned brightly. Father and son were at chess. The former, who possessed ideas about the game involving radical changes, putting his king into such sharp and unnecessary perils that it even provoked a comment from the white-haired old lady, knitting placidly by the fire. "Hark at the wind," said Mr. White, who, having seen a fatal mistake after it was too late, was amiably desirous of preventing his son from seeing it. "I'm listening," said the latter, grimly surveying the board as he stretched out his hand. "Check." "I should hardly think that he'd come tonight," said his father, with his hand poised over the board. "Mate," replied the son. "Oh, that's the worst of living so far out," bawled Mr. White, with sudden and unlooked-for violence. "Of all the beastly, slushy, out-of-the-way places to live in, this is the worst. Pathways are bog and the roads are torrent. I don't know what people are thinking about. I suppose because only 2 houses on the road are let, they think it doesn't matter." "Never mind, dear," said his wife soothingly. "Perhaps you'll win the next one." Mr. White looked up sharply, just in time to intercept a knowing glance between mother and son. The words died away on his lips, and he hid a guilty grin in his thin gray beard. "Ah, there he is," said Herbert White, as the gate banged to loudly and heavy footsteps came toward the door. The old man rose with hospitable haste, and opening the door was heard condoling with the new arrival. The new arrival also condoled with himself, so that Mrs. White said, "Tut, tut," and coughed gently as her husband entered the room, followed by a tall, burly man, beady of eye and rubicund of visage. "Sergeant Major Morris," he said, introducing him. The sergeant major shook hands and, taking the proffered seat by the fire, watched contentedly while his host got out whiskey and tumblers and stood a small copper kettle on the fire. At the 3rd glass, his eyes got brighter, and he began to talk, the little family circle regarding with eager interest this visitor from distant parts, as he squared his broad shoulders in the chair and spoke of strange scenes and doughty deeds, of wars and plagues and strange peoples. 21 years of it," said Mr. White, nodding at his wife and son. "When he went away, he was a slip of a youth in the warehouse. Now look at him." "Well, he don't look to have taken much harm," said Mrs. White politely. I'd like to go to India myself, said the old man. Just look round a bit, you know.
Better where you are, said the sergeant major, shaking his head.
He put down the empty glass and, sighing softly, shook it again. I should like to see those old temples and fakirs and jugglers, said the old man. What was that you started telling me the other day about a monkey's paw or something, Morris?
Nothing, said the soldier hastily. Leastwise, nothing worth hearing.
Monkey's paw? Said Mrs. White curiously.
Well, it's just a bit of what you might call magic, perhaps, said the sergeant major offhandedly. His three listeners leaned forward eagerly.
The visitor absent-mindedly put his empty glass to his lips and then set it down again. His host filled it for him.
To look at, said the sergeant major, fumbling in his pocket.
It's just an ordinary little paw dried to a mummy. He took something out of his pocket and proffered it. Mrs. White drew back with a grimace, but her son, taking it, examined it curiously.
And what is there special about it? Inquired Mr. White, as he took it from his son, and having examined it, placed it upon the table.
It had a spell put on it by an old fakir, said the sergeant major, a very holy man.
He wanted to show that fate ruled people's lives, and that those who interfered with it did so to their sorrow. He put a spell on it so that three separate men could each have three wishes from it.
His manner was so impressive that his hearers were conscious that their light laughter jarred somewhat.
Well, why don't you have three, sir? Said Herbert White cleverly. The soldier regarded him in the way that middle age is wont to regard presumptuous youth.
I have, he said quietly, and his blotchy face whitened.
And did you really have the three wishes granted? Asked Mrs. White.
I did, said the sergeant major, and his glass tapped against his strong teeth.
And has anybody else wished? Inquired the old lady.
The first man had his three wishes, yes, was the reply.
I don't know what the first two were, but the third was for death.
That's how I got the paw.
His tones were so grave that a hush fell upon the group. Well, if you've had your three wishes, it's no good to you now, then, Morris, said the old man at last. What do you keep it for?
The soldier shook his head. Fancy, I suppose, he said slowly.
Well, if you could have another three wishes, said the old man, eyeing him keenly, would you have them?
I don't know, said the other. I don't know.
He took the paw and, dangling it between his front finger and thumb, suddenly threw it upon the fire. White, with a slight cry, stooped down and snatched it off.
Better let it burn, said the soldier solemnly.
Well, if you don't want it, Morris, said the old man, give it to me.
I won't, said his friend doggedly. I threw it on the fire.
If you keep it, don't blame me for what happens. Pitch it on the fire again like a sensible man. The other shook his head and examined his new possession closely.
How do you do it? He inquired.
Hold it up in your right hand and wish aloud, said the sergeant major. But I warn you of the consequences.
Sounds like the Arabian Nights, said Mrs. White, as she rose and began to set the supper. Don't you think you might wish for four pairs of hands for me?
Her husband drew the talisman from his pocket, and then all three burst into laughter as the sergeant major, with a look of alarm on his face, caught him by the arm.
If you must wish, he said gruffly, wish for something sensible.
Mr. White dropped it back into his pocket and, placing chairs, motioned his friend to the table. In the business of supper, the talisman was partly forgotten, and afterward the three sat listening in an enthralled fashion to a second installment of the soldier's adventures in India.
Well,
If the tale about the monkey paw is not more truthful than those he's been telling us, said Herbert as the door closed behind their guest, just in time for him to catch the last train, we shan't make much out of it. Did you give him anything for it, Father? Inquired Mrs. White, regarding her husband closely. A trifle, he said, colouring slightly. He didn't want it, but I made him take it, and he pressed me again to throw it away. Ha! Likely, said Herbert, with pretended horror. Why, we're going to be rich and famous and happy. Wish to be an emperor, Father, to begin with, and you can't be henpecked. He darted round the table, pursued by the maligned Mrs. White, armed with an antimacassar. Mr. White took the paw from his pocket and eyed it dubiously. I don't know what to wish for. That's a fact, he said slowly. It seems to me I've got all I want. Well, if you only cleared the house, you'd be quite happy, wouldn't you? Said Herbert, with his hand on his shoulder. Well, wish for £200, then. That'll just do it. His father, smiling shamefacedly at his own credulity, held up the talisman as his son, with a solemn face, somewhat marred by a wink at his mother, sat down at the piano and struck a few impressive chords. I wish for £200, said the old man distinctly. A fine crash from the piano greeted the words, interrupted by a shuddering cry from the old man. His wife and son ran toward him. It moved, he cried, with a glance of disgust at the object as it lay on the floor. As I wished, it twisted in my hands like a snake. Well, I don't see the money, said his son, as he picked it up and placed it on the table. And I bet I never shall. It must have been your fancy, Father, said his wife, regarding him anxiously. He shook his head. Never mind. There's no harm done. But it gave me a shock, all the same. They sat down by the fire again while the two men finished their pipes. Outside, the wind was higher than ever, and the old man started nervously at the sound of a door banging upstairs. A silence, unusual and depressing, settled upon all three, which lasted until the old couple rose to retire for the night. I expect you'll find the cash tied up in a big bag in the middle of your bed, said Herbert as he bade them good night, and something horrible squatting upon top of the wardrobe, watching you as you pocket your ill-gotten gains. The old man sat alone in the darkness, gazing at the dying fire and seeing faces in it. The last face was so horrible and so simian that he gazed at it in amazement. It got so vivid that with an uneasy laugh he felt on the table for a glass containing a little water to throw over it. His hand grasped the monkey's paw, and with a little shiver he wiped his hand on his coat and went up to bed. 2. In the brightness of the wintry sun next morning, as it streamed over the breakfast table, Herbert laughed at his fears. There was an air of prosaic wholesomeness about the room which it had lacked on the previous night, and the dirty, shriveled little paw was pitched on the sideboard with a carelessness which betokened no great belief in its virtues. I suppose all old soldiers are the same, said Mrs. White. The idea of our listening to such nonsense. How could wishes be granted in these days? And if they could, how could £200 hurt you, Father? Oh, might drop on his head from the sky, said the frivolous Herbert. Morris said the things happened so naturally, said his father, that you might, if you so wished, attribute it to coincidence. Well, don't break into the money before I come back, said Herbert as he rose from the table. I'm afraid it'll turn you into a mean, avaricious man, and we shall have to disown you. His mother laughed, and following him to the door, watched him down the road, and returning to the breakfast table, was very happy at the expense of her husband's credulity. All of which did not prevent her from scurrying to the door at the postman's knock, nor prevent her from referring somewhat shortly to retired sergeant majors of bibulous habits when she found that the post brought a tailor's bill. Herbert will have some more of his funny remarks, I expect, when he comes home, she said, as they sat at dinner. I dare say, said Mr. White, pouring himself out some beer. But for all that, the thing moved in my hand. That I'll swear to. You thought it did, said the old lady soothingly. I say it did, replied the other. There was no thought about it. I just... Well, what's the matter? His wife made no reply. She was watching the mysterious movements of a man outside, who, peering in an undecided fashion at the house, appeared to be trying to make up his mind to enter. In mental connection with the £200, she noticed that the stranger was well-dressed and wore a silk hat of glossy newness. Three times he paused at the gate and then walked on again. The fourth time he stood with his hand upon it and then, with sudden resolution, flung it open and walked up the path. Mrs. White, at the same moment, placed her hands behind her and, hurriedly unfastening the strings of her apron, put that useful article of apparel beneath the cushion of her chair. She brought the stranger, who seemed ill at ease, into the room. He gazed at her furtively and listened in a preoccupied fashion as the old lady apologized for the appearance of the room and her husband's coat, a garment which he usually reserved for the garden. She then waited as patiently as her sex would permit for him to broach his business, but he was, at first, strangely silent.
I was asked to call, he said at last, and stooped and picked a piece of cotton from his trousers. I come from Moore and Meggins.
The old lady started. Is anything the matter? She asked, breathlessly. Has anything happened to Herbert? What is it? What is it? Her husband interposed. There, there, mother, he said hastily, sit down and don't jump to conclusions. You've not brought bad news, I'm sure, sir. And he eyed the other wistfully.
I'm sorry, began the visitor.
Is he hurt?
Demanded the mother. The visitor bowed in assent. Badly hurt, he said. But he is not in any pain.
Oh, thank God, said the old woman, clasping her hands. Oh, thank God for that. Thank...
She broke off suddenly, as the sinister meaning of the assurance dawned upon her, and she saw the awful confirmation of her fears in the other's averted face. She caught her breath, and turning to her slower-witted husband, laid her trembling old hand upon his. There was a long silence. He was caught in the machinery, said the visitor at length, in a low voice.
Caught in the machinery, repeated Mr. White, in a dazed fashion. Yes.
He sat staring blankly out the window and, taking his wife's hand between his own, pressed it as he had been wont to do in their old courting days nearly 40 years before.
He was the only one left to us, he said,
turning gently to the visitor.
It's hard.
The other coughed and, rising, walked slowly to the window.
The firm wished me to convey their sincere sympathy with you in your great loss, he said, without looking round. I beg that you will understand I am only their servant and merely obeying orders.
There was no reply. The old woman's face was white, her eyes staring, and her breath inaudible. On the husband's face was a look such as his friend the sergeant might have carried into his first action.
I was to say that Moore and Meggins disclaim all responsibility, continued the other. They admit no liability at all, but in consideration of your son's services, they wish to present you with a certain sum as compensation.
Mr. White dropped his wife's hand and, rising to his feet, gazed with a look of horror at his visitor. His dry lips shaped the words.
How much?
£200, was the answer. Unconscious of his wife's shriek, the old man smiled faintly, put out his hands like a sightless man, and dropped a senseless heap to the floor. 3. In the huge new cemetery some 2 miles distant, the old people buried their dead and came back to a house steeped in shadow and silence. It was all over so quickly that at first they could hardly realize it and remained in a state of expectation, as though of something else to happen, something else which was to lighten this load, too heavy for old hearts to bear. But the days passed and expectation gave place to resignation, the hopeless resignation of the old, sometimes miscalled apathy. Sometimes they hardly exchanged a word, for now they had nothing to talk about, and their days were long to weariness. It was about a week after that that the old man, waking suddenly in the night, stretched out his hand and found himself alone. The room was in darkness, and the sound of subdued weeping came from the window. He raised himself in bed and listened. "Come back," he said tenderly. "You'll be cold." "It is colder for my son," said the old woman, and wept afresh. The sound of her sobs died away on his ears. The bed was warm and his eyes heavy with sleep. He dozed fitfully and then slept until a sudden wild cry from his wife awoke him with a start. "The paw!" she cried wildly. "The monkey's paw!" He started up in alarm. Where? What is it? What's the matter?" She came stumbling across the room toward him. "I want it," she said quietly. "You've not destroyed it?" "It's in the parlor, on the bracket," he replied, marveling. "Why?" She cried and laughed together and, bending over, kissed his cheek. "I only just thought of it," she said hysterically. "Why didn't I think of it before? Why didn't you think of it?" "Think of what?" he questioned. "The other 2 wishes," she replied. "We've only had one." "Was not that enough?" he demanded fiercely. "No," she cried triumphantly. "We'll have one more. Go down and get it quickly and wish our boy alive again." The man sat up in bed and flung the bedclothes from his quaking lips. "Good God, you're mad," he cried, gasped. "Get it," she repented. "Get it quickly and wish, oh, my boy, my boy." Her husband struck a match and lit the candle. "Get back to bed," he said unsteadily. "You don't know what you're saying." "We had the first wish granted," said the old woman feverishly. "Why not the second?" A coincidence, stammered the old man. "Go and get it and wish," cried the old woman, quivering with excitement. The old man turned and regarded her, and his voice shook. "He has been dead 10 days, and besides, I would not tell you else, but I could only recognize him by his clothing. If he was too terrible for you to see then, how now? Bring him back," cried the old woman, and dragged him toward the door. "Do you think I fear the child I have nursed?" He went down in the darkness and felt his way to the parlor and then to the mantelpiece. The talisman was in its place, and a horrible fear that the unspoken wish might bring his mutilated son before him ere he could escape from the room seized upon him, and he caught his breath as he found that he had lost the direction of the door. His brow cold with sweat, he felt his way round the table and groped along the wall until he found himself in the small passage with the unwholesome thing in his hand. Even his wife's face seemed to change as he entered the room. It was white and expectant, and to his fears seemed to have an unnatural look upon it. He was afraid of her. "Wish," she cried in a strong voice. "It's foolish and wicked. Wish," repeated his wife. He raised his hand. "I wish my son alive again." The talisman fell to the floor, and he regarded it fearfully. Then he sank trembling into a chair as the old woman, with burning eyes, walked to the window and raised the blind. He sat until he was chilled with the cold, glancing occasionally at the figure of the old woman peering through the window. The candle end, which had burnt below the rim of the china candlestick, was throwing pulsating shadows on the ceiling and walls until, with a flicker larger than the rest, it expired. The old man, with an unspeakable sense of relief at the failure of the talisman, crept back to his bed, and a minute or two afterward, the old woman came silently and apathetically beside him. Neither spoke, but both lay silently listening to the ticking of the clock. A stair creaked, and a squeaky mouse scurried noisily through the wall. The darkness was oppressive, and after lying for some time, screwing up his courage, the husband took the box of matches and, striking one, went downstairs for a candle. At the foot of the stairs, the match went out, and he paused to strike another. And at the same moment, a knock. So quiet and stealthy as to be scarcely audible, sounded on the front door. The matches fell from his hand. He stood motionless, his breath suspended until the knock was repeated. Then he turned and fled swiftly back to his room and closed the door behind him. A third knock sounded through the house. "What's that?" cried the old woman, starting up. A rat, said the old man in shaking tones. A rat. It passed me on the stairs. His wife sat up in bed listening. A loud knock resounded through the house. "It's Herbert!" she screamed. "It's Herbert!" She ran to the door, but her husband was before her, and catching her by the arm, held her tightly. "What are you going to do?" he whispered hoarsely. "It's my boy! It's Herbert!" she cried, struggling mechanically. "I forgot it was 2 miles away! What are you holding me for? Let go! I must open the door!" "For God's sake, don't let it in!" cried the old man, trembling. "You're afraid of your own son!" she cried, struggling. "Let me go! I'm coming! Herbert! I'm coming!" There was another knock and another. The old woman, with a sudden wrench, broke free and ran from the room. Her husband followed to the landing and called after her appealingly as she hurried downstairs. He heard the chain rattle back and the bottom bolt drawn slowly and stiffly from the socket. Then the old woman's voice, strained and panting. "The bolt!" she cried loudly. "Come down! I can't reach it!" But her husband was on his hands and knees, groping wildly on the floor in search of the paw. If he could only find it before the thing outside got in! A perfect fusillade of knocks reverberated through the house, and he heard the scraping of a chair as his wife put it down in the passage against the door. He heard the creaking of the bolt as it came slowly back, and at the same moment he found the monkey's paw and frantically breathed his third and last wish. The knocking ceased suddenly, although the echoes of it were still in the house. He heard the chair drawn back and the door opened. A cold wind rushed up the staircase, and a long, loud wail of disappointment and misery from his wife gave him courage to run down to her side, and then to the gate beyond. The street lamp, flickering opposite, shone on a quiet and deserted road.
That was my reading of W.W. Jacobs' Spine Tingler, The Monkey's Paw. After a brief break, magical words from Isabel Allende. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm John Lithgow. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to selectedshorts.org or wnyc.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. The monkey's paw was a malevolent, enchanted object. But sometimes words alone can cast a spell. Our next story is Isabel Allende's lyrical story, Two Words. Here's our literary commentator, Hannah Tinti, to tell us a little about it. Hi, Hannah.
Hello, John.
They've heard plenty from me. Now it's time for you.
I'll do my best. In 1987, Allende published her novel Eva Luna, about a young woman who uses the power of storytelling to make her way in the world. Allende's next book was a collection, The Stories of Eva Luna, featuring the same character telling a group of tales to her lover in bed after he asks her, "Tell me a story you have never told anyone before." The first story Eva Luna tells is the story we're about to hear, Two Words. Two Words features another storyteller who is born into a family so poor they can't afford to name their children. Once our heroine learns to read, it changes her life forever. So this piece ends up being about the power of words and also their monetary value. Mark Twain used to say, "Don't use a $5 word when a 50-cent word will do." But this story got me thinking about how different words can be worth different amounts. A cat may be 50 cents, but lugubriously, that's got to be worth at least 20 bucks. How about you, John? Is there a word that you would pay very good money for?
How about lugubrious cat?
A lugubrious cat.
And now let's hear Two Words, read by an actor who grew up around words, Lisa Fugard, the daughter of playwright Ethel Fugard. Two Words by Isabel Allende.
She went by the name of Belisa Crepusculario, not because she had been baptized with that name or given it by her mother, but because she herself had searched until she found the poetry of beauty and twilight and cloaked herself in it. She made her living selling words. She journeyed through the country, from the high, cold mountains to the burning coasts, stopping at fairs and in markets, where she set up four poles covered by a canvas awning, under which she took refuge from the sun and rain to minister to her customers. She did not have to peddle her merchandise, because from having wandered far and near, everyone knew who she was. Some people waited for her from one year to the next, and when she appeared in the village with her bundle beneath her arm, they would form a line in front of her stall. Her prices were fair. For 5 centavos, she delivered verses from memory. For 7, she improved the quality of dreams. For 9, she wrote love letters. For 12, she invented insults for irreconcilable enemies. She also sold stories, not fantasies, but long, true stories she recited at one telling, never skipping a word. This is how she carried news from one town to another. People paid her to add a line or two. Our son was born, so-and-so died, our children got married, the crops burned in the field. Wherever she went, a small crowd gathered around to listen as she began to speak, and that was how they learned about each other's doings, about distant relatives, about what was going on in the Civil War. To anyone who paid her 50 centavos in trade, she gave the gift of a secret word to drive away melancholy. It was not the same word for everyone, naturally, because that would have been collective deceit. Each person received his or her own word with the assurance that no one else would use it that way in this universe or the beyond. Belisa Crepusculario had been born into a family so poor they did not even have names to give their children. She came into the world and grew up in an inhospitable land, where some years the rains became avalanches of water that bore everything away before them, and others where not a drop fell from the sky, and the sun swelled to fill the horizon, and the world became a desert. Until she was 12, Belisa had no occupation or virtue other than having withstood hunger and the exhaustion of centuries. During one interminable drought, it fell to her to bury 4 younger brothers and sisters. When she realized that her turn was next, she decided to set out to cross the plains in the direction of the sea, in hopes that she might trick death along the way. The land was eroded, split with deep cracks, strewn with rocks, fossils of trees and thorny bushes, and skeletons of animals bleached by the sun. From time to time, she ran into families who, like her, were heading south, following the mirage of water. Some had begun the march carrying their belongings on their back or in small carts, but they could barely move their own bones, and after a while, they had to abandon their possessions. They dragged themselves along painfully, their skin turned to lizard hide and their eyes burned by the reverberating glare. Belisa greeted them with a wave as she passed, but she did not stop because she had no strength to waste in acts of compassion. Many people fell by the wayside, but she was so stubborn that she survived to cross through that hell and at long last reach the first trickles of water, fine, almost invisible threads that fed spindly vegetation and farther down widened into small streams and marshes. Belisa Crepusculario saved her life and in the process accidentally discovered writing. In a village near the coast, the wind blew a page of newspaper at her feet. She picked up the brittle yellow paper and stood a long while looking at it, unable to determine its purpose, until curiosity overcame her shyness. She walked over to a man who was washing his horse in the muddy pool where she had quenched her thirst. "What is this?" she asked. "The sports page of the newspaper," the man replied, concealing his surprise at her ignorance. The answer astounded the girl, but she did not want to seem rude, so she merely inquired about the significance of the fly tracks scattered across the page. "Those are words, child. Here it says that Fulgenzio Barba knocked out El Negro Tiznao in the 3rd round." That was the day Belisa Crepusculario found out that words make their way in the world without a master, and that anyone with a little cleverness can appropriate them and do business with them. She made a quick assessment of her situation and concluded that aside from becoming a prostitute or working as a servant in the kitchens of the rich, there were few occupations she was qualified for. It seemed to her that selling words would be an honorable alternative. From that moment on, she worked at that profession and was never tempted by any other. At the beginning, she offered her merchandise, unaware that words could be written outside of newspapers. When she learned otherwise, she calculated the infinite possibilities of her trade, and with her savings, paid a priest 20 pesos to teach her to read and write. With her 3 remaining coins, she bought a dictionary. She pored over it from A to Z and then threw it into the sea because it was not her intention to defraud her customers with packaged words. One August morning, several years later, Belisa Crepusculario was sitting in her tent in the middle of a plaza surrounded by the uproar of market day, selling legal arguments to an old man who had been trying for 16 years to get his pension. Suddenly, she heard yelling and thudding hoofbeats. She looked up from her writing and saw, first a cloud of dust, and then a band of horsemen come galloping into the plaza. They were the Colonel's men, sent under orders of El Mulatto, a giant known throughout the land for the speed of his knife and his loyalty to his chief. Both the Colonel and El Mulatto had spent their lives fighting in the Civil War, and their names were ineradicably linked to devastation and calamity. The rebels swept into town like a stampeding herd, wrapped in noise, bathed in sweat, and leaving a hurricane of fear in their trail. Chickens took wing. Dogs ran for their lives. Women and children scurried out of sight until the only living soul left in the market was Belisa Crepusculario. She had never seen El Mulatto and was surprised to see him walking toward her. "I'm looking for you," he shouted, pointing his coiled whip at her. Even before the words were out, two men rushed her, knocking over her canopy and shattering her inkwell, bound her hand and foot, and threw her like a sea bag across the rump of El Mulatto's mount. Then they thundered off toward the hills. Hours later, just as Belisa Crepusculario was near death, her heart ground to sand by the pounding of the horse, they stopped, and four strong hands set her down. She tried to stand on her feet and hold her head high, but her strength failed her, and she slumped to the ground, sinking into a confused dream. She awakened, several hours later, to the murmur of night in the camp. But before she had time to sort out the sounds, she opened her eyes and found herself staring into the impatient glare of El Mulatto kneeling beside her. "Well, woman, at last you've come to," he said. To speed her to her senses, he tipped his canteen and offered her a sip of liquor laced with gunpowder. She demanded to know the reason for such rough treatment, and El Mulatto explained that the Colonel needed her services. He allowed her to splash water on her face and then led her to the far end of the camp, where the most feared man in all the land was lazing in a hammock strung between two trees. She could not see his face because he lay in the deceptive shadow of the leaves and the indelible shadow of all his years as a bandit. But she imagined, from the way his gigantic aide addressed him with such humility, that he must have a very menacing expression. She was surprised by the Colonel's voice, as soft and well modulated as a professor's. "Are you the woman who sells words?" he asked. "At your service," she stammered, peering into the dark and trying to see him better. The Colonel stood up and turned straight toward her. She saw dark skin and the eyes of a ferocious puma, and she knew immediately that she was standing before the loneliest man in the world. "I want to be president," he announced. The Colonel was weary of riding across that godforsaken land, waging useless wars and suffering defeats that no subterfuge could transform into victories. For years, he had been sleeping in the open air, bitten by mosquitoes, eating iguanas and snake soup. But those minor inconveniences were not why he wanted to change his destiny. What truly troubled him was the terror he saw in people's eyes. He longed to ride into a town beneath a triumphal arch with bright flags and flowers everywhere. He wanted to be cheered and be given newly laid eggs and freshly baked bread. Men fled at the sight of him, children trembled, and women miscarried from fright. He had had enough, and so he had decided to become president. El Mulatto had suggested that they ride to the capital, gallop up to the palace, and take over the government, the way they had taken so many other things without anyone's permission. The colonel, however, did not want to be just another tyrant. There had been enough of those before him, and besides, if he did that, he would never win people's hearts. It was his aspiration to win the popular vote in the December elections. "To do that, I have to talk like a candidate. Can you sell me the words for a speech?" the colonel asked Belisa Crepusculario. She had accepted many assignments, but none like this. She did not dare refuse, fearing that El Mulatto would shoot her between the eyes, or worse still, that the colonel would burst into tears. There was more to it than that, however. She felt the urge to help him because she felt a throbbing warmth beneath her skin, a powerful desire to touch that man, to fondle him, to clasp him in her arms. All night, and a good part of the following day, Belisa Crepusculario searched her repertory for words adequate for a presidential speech, closely watched by El Mulatto, who could not take his eyes from her firm wanderer's legs and virginal breasts. She discarded harsh, cold words, words that were too flowery, words worn from abuse, words that offered improbable promises, untruthful and confusing words, until all she had left were words sure to touch the minds of men and women's intuition. Calling upon the knowledge she had purchased from the priest for 20 pesos, she wrote the speech on a sheet of paper and then signaled El Mulatto to untie the rope that bound her ankles to a tree. He led her once more to the colonel, and again she felt the throbbing anxiety that had seized her when she first saw him. She handed him the paper and waited while he looked at it, holding it gingerly between thumbs and fingertips. "What the shit does this say?" he asked finally. "Don't you know how to read?" "War's what I know," he replied. She read the speech aloud. She read it 3 times so her client could engrave it on his memory. When she finished, she saw the emotion in the faces of the soldiers who had gathered round to listen, and saw that the colonel's eyes glittered with enthusiasm, convinced that with those words, the presidential chair would be his. "If after they've heard it 3 times, the boys are still standing there with their mouths hanging open, it must mean the thing's damn good, colonel," was El Mulatto's approval. "All right, woman, how much do I owe you?" the leader asked. "1 peso, colonel." "That's not much," he said, opening the pouch he wore at his belt, heavy with proceeds from the last foray. "The peso entitles you to a bonus. I'm going to give you 2 secret words, said Belisa Crepusculario. "What for?" She explained that for every 50 centavos a client paid, she gave him the gift of a word for his exclusive use. The colonel shrugged. He had no interest at all in her offer, but he did not want to be impolite to someone who had served him so well. She walked slowly to the leather stool where he was sitting and bent down to give him her gift. The man smelled the scent of a mountain cat issuing from the woman, a fiery heat radiating from her hips. He heard the terrible whisper of her hair, and a breath of sweet mint murmured into his ear the 2 secret words that were his alone. "They are yours, colonel," she said as she stepped back. "You may use them as much as you please." El Mulatto accompanied Belisa to the roadside, his eyes as entreating as a stray dog's. But when he reached out to touch her, he was stopped by an avalanche of words he had never heard before. Believing them to be an irrevocable curse, the flame of his desire was extinguished. During the months of September, October, and November, the colonel delivered his speech so many times that had it not been crafted from glowing and durable words, it would have turned to ash as he spoke. He traveled up and down and across the country, riding into cities with a triumphal air, stopping in even the most forgotten villages, where only the dump heap betrayed a human presence, to convince his fellow citizens to vote for him. While he spoke from a platform erected in the middle of the plaza, El Mulato and his men handed out sweets and painted his name on all the walls in gold frost. No one paid the least attention to those advertising ploys. They were dazzled by the clarity of the colonel's proposals and the poetic lucidity of his arguments. Infected by his powerful wish to right the wrongs of history, happy for the first time in their lives. When the candidate had finished his speech, his soldiers would fire their pistols into the air and set off firecrackers. And when finally they rode off, they left behind a wake of hope that lingered for days on the air, like the splendid memory of a comet's tail. Soon the colonel was the favorite. No one had ever witnessed such a phenomenon. A man who surfaced from the Civil War, covered with scars and speaking like a professor. A man whose fame spread to every corner of the land and captured the nation's heart. The press focused their attention on him. Newspapermen came from far away to interview him and repeat his phrases. And the number of his followers and enemies continued to grow. "We're doing great, Colonel," said El Mulato, after 12 successful weeks of campaigning. But the candidate did not hear. He was repeating his secret words, as he did more and more obsessively. He said them when he was mellow with nostalgia. He murmured them in his sleep. He carried them with him on horseback. He thought them before delivering his famous speech, and he caught himself savoring them in his leisure time. And every time he thought of those two words, he thought of Belisa Crepusculario, and his senses were inflamed with the memory of her feral scent, her fiery heat, the whisper of her hair, and her sweet mint breath in his ear, until he began to go around like a sleepwalker. And his men realized that he might die before he ever sat in the presidential chair. "What's got hold of you, Colonel?" El Mulato asked so often that finally one day his chief broke down and told him the source of his befuddlement. Those two words that were buried like two daggers in his gut. "Tell me what they are and maybe they'll lose their magic," his faithful aide suggested. "I can't tell them. They're for me alone," the colonel replied. Saddened by watching his chief decline like a man with a death sentence on his head, El Mulato slung his rifle over his shoulder and set out to find Belisa Crepusculario. He followed her trail through all that vast country until he found her in a village in the far south, sitting under her tent, reciting her rosary of news. He planted himself, spraddle-legged before her, weapon in hand. "You, you're coming with me," he ordered. She had been waiting. She picked up her inkwell, folded the canvas of her small stall, arranged her shawl around her shoulders, and without a word, took her place behind El Mulato's saddle. They did not exchange so much as a word in all the trip. El Mulato's desire for her had turned into rage, and only his fear of her tongue prevented his cutting her to shreds with his whip. Nor was he inclined to tell her that the colonel was in a fog, and that a spell whispered into his ear had done what years of battle had not been able to do. 3 days later, they arrived at the encampment, and immediately In view of all the troops, El Mulatto led his prisoner before the candidate. I brought this witch here so you can give her back her words, Colonel, El Mulatto said, pointing the barrel of his rifle at the woman's head. And then she can give you back your manhood. The Colonel and Belisa Crepusculario stared at each other, measuring one another from a distance. The men knew then that their leader would never undo the witchcraft of those accursed words, because the whole world could see the voracious puma eyes soften as the woman walked to him and took his hand in hers.
Lisa Fugard performed Isabel Allende's Two Words. I'm John Lithgow. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, Wondrous Women in stories by E. Nesbitt and Barbara Kingsolver. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Malcolm Donaldson. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the best American short stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Perotta. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the short story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust's Program for Performing Arts Groups, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI Public Radio International.
PRI Public Radio International.